that as well as much as I could with this book. Yeah.
Well, maybe this is a good time to hear a little bit of the poetry.
Sure.
I've picked out two, page 24 and page 35.
Okay. Conquistadors. Sunrise over a dirt road, by a low wire fence, bird song. A rooster crows, then distant church bells, pealing arpeggios in the thin air. Two horses graze next to a roofless ruin. Light slowly swells, expands, fills the heavens, awakens the undergrowth, and the blood of the defeated running fast through the earth. Called minorities by conquest, swept along, on and beyond the state's three reservations, land once a republic of raids and counter-raids, of alliances kept and broken, of patara bueyes humanos sumas cados, of arbados, cutalchuches, Higarias, Lipans, of Chibolos, Kickapoos, Susolas, Kitoles, Malacones, of Neches, Coayas, Coyoteros, Atayos, Apaches, Comanches, Atacapans, of Piros, Mescaleros, Wichitas, Tauvayas, Tonkawas, Bidais, Teas, Cheyens, Kiowas, Karankawas, Utahs, and on, diverse nations known through paged, named each stretch of sand, unspoken presence. I hope I got some of those pronunciations okay. That was the first time I read that. Although I always read it aloud.
Yeah, it's a difficult. I chose a difficult.
No, it's great. I'm glad. I like it. And this is called Substation. And actually, this is the first substation poem I wrote for the book, but I think it's the second one that appears in the book. Substation. Live lines lead to the substation grid, vital node between the tracks and a lonely row of small houses, where an asphalt road meets lattice towers, high-tension buses and switches. Transmission lines sail to lightning gyres. Lugs fix cross strut to strut transformers induct. Step up, step down, fenced off structure. Wooden pylons against sand and sky. Insulators, isolators, arresters. X'd constructed monument to the unknown prisoner. Receding cube within cube of walls of air. Pantographic galvanized gantry, breaker and fuse, relay equipage, kilovolts hum unending ohm of the lamp's transmission, down at the switchyard, through the body, electromagnetic, lines bond totemic, linked, desert succulents, less wilderness, less relentless wasteland, lines, further prospect, toward a pure array of sun.
I've been listening to Jeffrey Yang read from Hey Marfa from Grey Wolf Press. I forgot that this poem has a nod to Whitman with the line through the body, electromagnetic.
Right, yeah.
But I do want to ask you about Walt Whitman.
Okay, yeah.
Because recently I had Tommy Pico on. He's from the Kumeyaay Nation near San Diego.
Yeah.
And his work explicitly declares a distrust of the first person plural use of we and an ambivalence to abstract language.
Yeah.
So I was asking him questions, particularly as an indigenous poet, about his feelings about Walt Whitman.
Mm-hmm.
Since Whitman is explicitly trying to embody the American experiment, and because he employs a seemingly universal I and we in the service of a sort of poetic nation building, and because Whitman has a spotty, troublesome, and contradictory set of views toward indigenous people, toward African Americans, toward Mexicans, and others that he didn't see quite fitting into the American experiment as he saw it. And all of Tommy Pico's books are book length.
Uh-huh.
And so at one point I asked him what books influenced him, and he said Vanishing Line is one of the books that was influential. And I hadn't read it yet at the time. Uh-huh. This was a couple months ago.
Right.
And so I didn't know that your book, Vanishing Line, engages with the genocide of Native nations and also quotes Walt Whitman directly. So that was an interesting segue and coincidence. And I wanted to just read a short passage that you quote in Vanishing Line and then ask you some questions.
Sure.
So this is what you say in Vanishing Line. Whitman, who in March 1846 calls the slave trade a monstrous business, a disgrace and a blot on the character of the Republic, 1 year later writes, "With the present slave states, of course, no human being anywhere out from themselves has the least shadow of a right to interfere." 10 years later, he shifts emphasis and says, speaking about Africa, "In their own country, degraded, cruel, almost bestial, the victims of cruel chiefs and of bloody religious rites, lives never secure, no education, no refinement, no elevation, no political knowledge. Such is the general condition of the African tribes. It is also to be remembered that no race ever can remain slaves if they have it in them to become free. Why do the slave ships go to Africa only?" So I was wondering if you could speak to why we find these lines in Vanishing Line and how, as an American poet yourself and a poet of color, how you orient yourself to Whitman and sort of his embodiment of the national project. Because when I think about, like, when we were talking about L.C. Bright,
right,
and I said, is there violence in this abstraction? And you said, yes, maybe, but it's also really beautiful. And clearly Whitman is very beautiful.
Yeah.
And then we go back to the epigram that that you have at the beginning of the book,
mm-hmm,
that truthful things aren't beautiful.
Yeah.
I'm curious. So tell us about Whitman here in Vanishing Line, and then maybe you can you can broaden that to some of the stuff you're exploring in the Marfa exploration.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a good question. I mean, well, just first, I mean, Whitman, I should also say too, because you mentioned in the intro, I also edited this book of Whitman's writings focused on the sea, the poetry and the prose. I mean, Whitman, I have such an admiration for that first edition of Leaves of Grass, which came out in 1855, and these long lines and all these weird ellipses and dots and no titles and these long lines and what it was trying to do at that time. I mean, but it also, it's true. I mean, Whitman is a very contradictory and controversial figure, in the sense that he also was, you know, his own best publicist in ways, and so I think in Vanishing Line, in that particular, where those lines come up, it was in a long poem called Yenicott in that book, and that book dealt with a lot of the history in the northern tip of Long Island, and so Whitman there, it was important to kind of, for me, to bring in there, like, one, because you know, Whitman loved Long Island and he walked along the beaches there, and also as the figure of our most probably revered poet in the U.S. you know, but then also seeing, like, some of the letters in his, I think it's his journals, I can't remember, for it's all in this, these complete works. You could see the prose, a lot of this other prose, that isn't as well read, at least previously. And you could see some of these things that he's thinking about race, but then it's so interesting because he keeps it out of the poetry. You know, he keeps that out of the poetry. It's almost like he's editing himself in a way. But then in these articles, which sometimes aren't even attributed to him, but like as an editorial kind of thing for the paper he happened to be working at the time, or in that sense. So, but it was kind of shocking to read those things, actually, because I had heard about them. I'd actually first read, you know, pieces about that, and then to actually go and find it and read it, It's pretty shocking, and it's never taught like that. You know, Whitman is not a complicated figure when you learn about him. When I learned about him in high school, and so for me, it was one way in that poem where I was dealing with kind of the history and mythology of that area, or of that kind of imagined place. That he was a part of that landscape. And so in here too, you know, when you're talking about the opening of the West and you're thinking about the desert and just that and a lot of that history, you know, there's some of the kind of old railroad history that comes in too, you know, which connects to the technology of the wires, you know. It's a similar kind of thing, this idea of what America was supposed to be, you know, and what it really was. And there's such a contrast between that ideal and the real of what was really going on. And Whitman, of course, was always talking about the ideal and the real in poetry and in prose. And so it's those kinds of themes, you know, they're all throughout our history here, and so he became part of the text too, in a way.
You have that line in Hey Marfa, we extend his leaves with acts of conquest.
Right, exactly. And so that was spoken through a character in the book, a named Straw, and so. Yeah, I mean, I'm more of the reader who will, you know, still read Whitman and still appreciate so much about his work. But it doesn't have to be for me a complete kind of reverence and devotion anymore.
Yeah, no, I mean, you have a complicated
exactly.
View
and I think that's it. And I think it's, you know, it's an interesting perspective to have that you say we don't have as much for someone like Emily Dickinson, who is much more, I mean, seeing those two figures as kind of the founding people of American poetry, in a
right.
way, you know, as always pointed to as such, for better or for worse. And so...
Well, it's weird how she, the more we allow her poems to be the way they really were written, mm-hmm. the more and more she seems avant-garde today.
Yeah, it's true.
But there's a settler, or a quote from a settler in Vanishing Line, mm-hmm. It reminded me of Whitman and regarding the danger of people becoming abstractions. So the settler says, after the Christians have multiplied and the natives have disappeared and melted away, a memorial of them may be preserved. And it made me think of how Whitman was very much for preserving native place names mm-hmm. across the country. He wanted them preserved unilaterally, I think, and uniformly. Like, he wanted the names of the places to be the native names, but he did seem less concerned about the ultimate actual end game for the native people themselves. And there's a poem he has at the end of his life about the redwoods disappearing that a mm-hmm. lot of people think is sort of a elegy for the red people mm-hmm. also, that the redwoods would disappear and the red people would disappear and sort of as part of the inevitable die out for the American project.
Right.
So I want to read one more quote outside of your work
okay.
by the critical theorist Homi Bhabha uh-huh. that says, the void that emerges through the act of writing is not an evocative abstraction lost in the mists of metaphor. The void is, quite literally, the empty space of erasure and extermination, of missing persons, destroyed things, hidden histories, lost records, expropriated lands, murdered minorities. The humanist must graphically evoke such emptiness and erasure without sublimating these absences, remaining all the while wary of every dream and nation. And I guess I wondered what your thoughts were on that quote, because mm-hmm. to me that's a really good description of Hey Marfa.
Yeah.
That it's graphically evoking emptiness as erasure,
uh-huh.
making visible the absences without sublimating them. But I didn't know if you even sign on to the sentiment of the quote in the first place. So I was curious what your thoughts were about maybe one of the projects being to make graphic what has been erased.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know what the exact context of the quote, of course, but from what you read there, I mean, no, I would agree with that too, because it's, I mean, in this book, I was also trying. You're talking about the graphic representation, but the poems unfold in a very visual way too. I mean, they're not just left justified or something, and so and that took. That was a big part of how I was writing this book, and so, and one of the reasons why, I mean, you're talking about hidden histories and things, and so, I mean, one is that I've always, I think of poetry on one level as a kind of digging, and digging, below the surface of things, to kind of deeper truths and trying to figure those things out. And also that this landscape, this desert landscape, it could be deceptively recursive in a way, repetitive. You're kind of driving out there or walking, and it's you could be complete you're I mean I'm just com I was just completely overwhelmed by that contrast between the scrub and the sand, the hills in the distance, and then the sky, which is just enormous, and something's going on in the air there too. But then, as you look more closely, and people have asked me this before, and I don't know how else to say it, so I'm gonna have to repeat myself here. But as you look more closely, you really see how diverse even just the ecological life, the plants and the animals live there and have found a home there, and it's the same with us as well. And so the book kind of unfolds in this kind of visual way, and on the one hand trying to echo some of that recursiveness through how the poems are laid out, and also things that kind of come back in different ways, themes and lines, and yeah, and trying to really delve into some of those kind of places in history or how we view kind of nature in a way that have been, I don't know, overlooked in ways, or kind of deliberately repressed, through our through the way we've kind of dominate the land here. Yeah, so those are some of the things that
Well, as we move toward Marfa and through Marfa and through the landscape, where we get, it's punctuated by high voltage substations, but it's also punctuated by caves, some of which are the site of the deaths of Chinese laborers,
Yeah, exactly.
thousands of which died blasting tunnels for the railroad. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about that history. I mean, I'm imagining you and Marfa also, you're doing Chinese translation and also finding this Chinese history. I don't know how memorialized or how buried that history is, and how visible is that history, or how much did you have to turn over things to find it?
Particularly with the Chinese railroad. Yeah. No, I mean, that's something that I learned about since college. Really. I mean, not much in high school, but it was really in college when that I read more and looked more at that history, and it's also when you're dealing with these histories and these things, it becomes immediately complicated, and you're having to find the right balance, at least for me, in trying to write about it. On the one hand, if you look at the history of kind of say Chinese American writing, poets, novelists in the U.S., there's a point where you see that they were almost expected to write about these things. They're kind of like pigeonholed into these kinds of themes and stuff like that, which isn't a fair way to look at the work. But at the same time, I think coming out of that, one being the child of Chinese immigrants, to the U.S. It's already kind of there for me to look at, but it's also part of the greater history too. I mean, that's the thing, and so I wanted to write about it. And for this particular history, it's also very hard to write about because there's no written records. I mean, that's in the poem. That's in the poem that I think you're talking about there. There's really no records. There's no letters or anything, and so that's always been. It's still to this day, you read about that history, and it's hard because people hope there's some archive maybe, and or some family library where there's some letters or something there. But you know, who knows? And so you're dealing with different kinds of things. You're dealing with like archaeology, you know, and your other disciplines, you know, come in to play very quickly when you're looking at that history. And so as far as the opening of the West is concerned, and dealing with whatever this idea of the West is, we have that history of the railroads is just kind of completely necessary, I think, yeah. To think about, you know. And so, if you're looking at it from the perspective of how it's been treated in, say, Hollywood or in a lot of writing, it's always usually an afterthought or just kind of something, a setting, you know. And so I wanted to kind of like bring that in more deeply in a way if I could.
Well, I love how we don't get the Marfa of reputation until really deep in the book. So we go very far in Hey Marfa before we get the famous art of Marfa or even your art making in Marfa. But in the heart of the book, we do get a series of poems that are a conversation with this character you mentioned, the gunslinger Straw.
Right.
Who shares his thoughts on nonviolence, on memory, on the nature of Marfa, and more. So tell us about Straw, who he is, and how you see him functioning in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of half think it's better for readers if they look at it to figure that out themselves. But I could say like a few things about that. Yeah, no, for sure. that's why I'm here. But so those poems, I mean, it definitely comes directly out of the idea of the gunslinger, you know, it comes out of Ed Dorn's book, Gunslinger, his gunslinger poems. But then he, of course, was dealing with the cliche of the gunslinger in the West, in the history of the West.
Whose poems?
Edward Dorn.
Ed Dorn.
And so, I mean, what he's doing with it, that he calls him gunslinger throughout, and what he's doing is, you know, is different in his long poem, but that figure, to make kind of to shorten it into Straw, STRA, it's one of the places in the book where there's really a multivalent title. It's because those poems are titled Straw and Figure in the book. It was, you know, one of the few really great epiphanies for me I had coming upon that, because it really opened up a way for me to write about some of the things in those poems that I was really struggling with in trying to deal with. And so by giving it a voice to this figure, which kind of alludes to many things, it could be, you know, strata or straw, like a straw man, or, you know, or even a little bit rack straw. But of course that's not him. But so some of these things that and other things that come in with that name really helped me figure out a way to write about that, and also to write about it in the voice, to make it a bit more fun, but also dealing with it in a kind of trying to engage with that, with the subject matter of those poems, you know, through this other voice again, like you're saying. But in this case, it was a made up voice through, or imagined voice through Straw. Yeah.
Can we hear one of them?
Oh yeah, sure.
Page 56.
Sure. Okay. Okay. You always choose the long ones. <Just kidding.
laughs> Are they all long?
No. I just meant like some of the substation. No, I'm fine. Most people choose a short one. So okay. Straw. Marfa is no arid La Jolla. No Palm Springs decoy, Straw holds forth. No, not even a crude tract of La Mancha. They'll lance a windmill here, and you'll be shot faster than you can say Ali Fanfaron. This place is perceived as a small, cosmopolitan oasis, celebrated for its current industry, art. Art as external creative force, more careful development. Mather's squalid desert. An art island that depends on poor locals and neighboring islands to keep costs down. And while not as shaka as Molokai, there's no hurry or rush. Rather, it's one contained speed trap. Push the gas and you'll find yourself at the pink courthouse, begging at the bench of Judge Cinderella, who will take cash for not changing your Prius into a pumpkin. Immigrants, illegals, cruelers and crafters, adobe mixers, day trippers, homesitters, hydroponic tomato pickers, ranchers, loners, passing celebrities and photo shooters if passing quickly, registered sex offenders if not offending, poets and failures, javelina, sausage makers, bond makers, readers and home birthers, all make up the local fix. A place of few first words, desperado bookishness, no public playground, kids scarce, public schools in a downswing, low rent housing, harder to come by as out-of-towners buy and sell and buy. Population waivers around 2,000, 70% Obama voters. Most common surname Sanchez or Martinez, pick your plot, Latino or Anglo. Bookstores to die for, ditto the radio station, cozy library, camp in a trailer, eat Mediterranean in a trailer, drool over Ramona's burritos. Chain scarce, mind clears, leave your pretense at the Prada. A quiet simplicity settles in. To start anew or continue to lose your way and loose your imagination farther out to Presidio's giant battery reserve. Straw pauses. Tosses back his mescalero. And I noticed a scar running across the gular skin of his throat. But hey, Marfa, what do I know? I just got here. Tomorrow, hasta pronto. An airstrip would kill you.
It was great having you on the show today, Jeffrey.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
We're talking today to Jeffrey Yang, reading from his latest poetry collection, Hey Marfa, from Grey Wolf Press. You've been listening to Between the Covers.
Take the listening to KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy jueves 15 de julio del 2021. Los casos y muertes en el mundo por COVID-19 están aumentando, impulsados por brotes crónicos en América Latina y casos en aumento en el sudeste asiático, África y Medio Oriente. La Organización Mundial de la Salud advierte sobre aumentos exponenciales de infecciones en Libia, Irán, Irak y en Túnez, donde los trabajadores médicos informaron que se han quedado sin oxígeno y sin camas para pacientes con coronavirus. Ahmed Gout dice, ahora no tenemos